Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome to the Solari Report a distinguished former government servant. I would say Zach Taylor was a Border Patrol officer serving the United States government from 1976 to 2003, much of it along the Southwest border. And since that time, he's the founder of the National Association of Former Border Patrol Officers, which also includes members from the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And he has recently been known for speaking widely, and the association speaking widely, on some of the things that are happening on the border. I've put up his videos. They're going to be movie of the week as well. And I can't encourage you strongly enough to watch them. But I wanted to get Zach on to talk more deeply about some of the information he and the association have presented, and to underscore how important I think it is that you familiar yourself with it and with Zach's work. So, Zach, welcome to the Solari Report. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your years as a Border Patrol officer. How did you come to be one, and what were some of the highlights of your experience?
Well, I started out in the great state of Florida as a game warden. And I left that because there was too much politics involved with game and fish management in the state of Florida at that time. It ran afoul with the Development Commission and the Tourist Bureau and various other organizations that had a vested interest in things other than the preservation of wildlife and the natural resources. And so I thought I'd get away from politics and join the Border Patrol.
Yeah.
And much to my surprise, I found out that it also was afflicted with its own problems with the relations to people that have personal interests that run counter to the interest of the people of the United States. And that I could reconcile myself to the alligators and the catfish and the turtles in Florida, but when it comes down to the lives of the American people, well, that's altogether a different matter. And during my career, I spent my entire career, my whole 26 plus years, actually on the border. And my main job literally was hunting people, literally. And to do that, you know, the most challenging prey on earth is an armed person.
Right.
And it takes someone with a little bit different outlook on life to do that kind of work, do it well, and like it. And if you've ever done that kind of work and liked it, you really, as Ernest Hemingway said, you really don't, nothing ever after really gets you too much excited. So I found my calling. I really did like the challenge of going hunting every day.
Right.
And you didn't have to find freezer space for them. You just had to find detention space.
So, right.
And I had a lot of help with that. And I got pretty good at it. And it's called real-time intelligence. And what it is you try and decide what the guy's going to do next. And you do that based on your observations of what he's already done.
Right.
And, and in the intelligence world, that's kind of tricky. Because his job is to try not to set a pattern or a trend or put up any markers to where you can predict accurately how you can get close enough to him to put your hands on him. Because that's the nature of the beast in the immigration business, is actually to be able to put your hands, literally, on the violator to take them into custody and then essentially to get them to jail.
Right. Now, you were...
That's what I did.
You were basically enforcing the immigration laws along the southwestern border. So it was Arizona and Texas.
Exclusively. I did 12 years in Texas, 9 in McAllen, 3 at Brackettville, and I did over 14 here in Nogales, Arizona.
And how many of the people that you were dealing with were being brought over by professional smugglers?
Well, that varied. And when I was in McAllen, Texas, the bulk of what I was assigned to do was just exactly that, because I was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have spent easily over half of my time doing that. And that would be people that were being walked through the ranch land. That would be people who would be smuggled out on aircraft or commercial transportation, automobile, just however they did it, train.
Right.
Sometimes they used freight trains to put their people on and then pick them up on the other end. Right. It just all depended. We had one guy there. His name was George. We named him that. It wasn't his real name. But he would walk his people over 100 miles from where his point of entrance into the United States to where he would have them picked up inside the United States. And he
right.
was really difficult to deal with because he didn't always take the same trail. So you had to more or less follow him each time and overtake him. And that was pretty difficult because a lot of times he'd walk the highways and leave no tracks at night, because in that part of rural Texas, there's very little vehicle traffic on the highways at night. So you wouldn't have anything to follow. You would just it was the hunter's instinct.
Right.
And if you didn't have it, you weren't going to catch George.
Right.
So you
retired, and then when did you form the association, and why did you form the association?
Well, myself and a large number of my contemporaries that retired in that time span from about 1995 to about 2007 had actually worked in the 86 amnesty when, during the Reagan administration, they signed the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, which was supposed to have been the one and only, the very last amnesty that the United States government would ever offer. And we saw how horrible that was. And just to give you an idea, they started out saying that there was going to be about 800,000 people that were going to benefit from the provisions of this act, which in the final analysis was pretty accurate. The people that would legitimately benefit from the provisions of this act was probably about 750,000, 800,000 people. Well, the problem is that more people than were actually qualified or were entitled to benefits under the act actually applied. So as these applications were rolling into the legalization offices across the Southwest, the people in these offices saw that these were fraudulent applications, that these people simply were not the benefits of the act weren't available to them because they didn't qualify. So they packaged up all these rejected applications and sent them off to Washington, D.C., and promptly received them back with waivers. In other words, they waived the inadmissibility of the alien simply because he fraudulently applied for benefits. So instead of having the 750,000-800,000 applicants, whatever it was dying to be, there was over 3 million, 3.3 or something like that million applications, of which 2.7 million were adjudicated. Well, in some offices, 75% of those applications were fraud on their face, were given waivers. And so what we did, essentially, is we trained the people that would apply for benefits under an act like this. We trained them to lie, cheat, and steal. Because the way it works in these foreign countries is everything is word of mouth. In other words, that person comes from a particular part of Mexico. Let's say they're from Cananea, Sonora. And they go back to their home in Cananea, Sonora, and they tell them how they screwed Uncle Sam. Yeah, well, we claimed this, and we went to this lawyer, and we paid him this much money, and he gave us these papers to file. And we'd never been in the United States before in our life, but we said we'd been here picking strawberries off of trees. Well, when you take and you read the application, and the person's claiming to be an agricultural worker, and he says that for 3 years at this place in Georgia, he was picking strawberries off of trees. Well, strawberries don't grow on trees.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that these things were so obviously fraudulent on their face that it became a joke, not only within the Immigration Service, but among the people that were applying. In other words, the government was not looking to adjudicate the people that had a legitimate claim. They were looking for numbers, and they didn't know how they got them.
Right.
So we trained these people to do this stuff. So what we did was we created the demand, both in Washington, both in the minds of the American people and the minds of the illegal alien, that all he's got to do is wait until the next stupid moment that the United States has, when they have another amnesty of sorts, and be here to apply and benefit from it. So essentially, this Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, was that signal. And it set out the opportunity for people up to age 31 who were either by implication already in the United States, or those planning to come, should they be apprehended during their entry and passage into the United States, the government had decided that they weren't going to take any action against these people and would allow them to apply for this deferred action. Well, it's just another form of fraud against the immigration laws of the United States.
Zach, when was that policy implemented? I thought it was a year ago.
A little over 2 years ago.
2 years ago, okay.
A little over. So what we had in a surge starting about 18 months before April of 2014, so it was going to be, it was going to be in 2012. They were filtering these people from Central America that were unaccompanied males. Basically, between the age of 13 and 18, most of them were actually a little younger than that. And they were going through a processing facility in California at a naval base. And this was run by Department of Homeland Security, the U.S. Navy, and Health and Human Services. And basically, these were males, young, unmarried, and they said that they were coming here to be present when President Obama declared another amnesty in August of 2014. 90% of them, over 90%, said that they were not fleeing poverty, they were not fleeing violence, they were only coming here to get a benefit, a free benefit, that the president was going to give them by virtue of the fact that they were inside the United States when he waved his magic pencil and said, okay, you can stay.
And who paid their travel expenses up to the United States?
Now, on this particular group, the ones before April of 2014, it's mostly them or their relatives that live outside of the country or their relatives that live inside the country, or they made it on their own. In other words, it was by hook or by crook. They got on the train, the beast, they came up, they hitchhiked. It may have taken them 3 months to get here. It may have taken them 5 months to get here. But from the time they left their home country in Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador before they actually got to the United States.
Is there any evidence to suggest that the American government represented in those countries is encouraging them to come?
Yes. and it's word of mouth and hearsay, because it's very difficult when you go to a foreign country and you see something that is on a billboard or in a newspaper or even on television to get an attribution as the source.
Right.
Well, who did it? Well, you know, somebody gave us $350 and we did it. You know, they gave us a piece of paper and they gave us the money, so we put it up there. They don't have the copyrights and all this other stuff like Americans are burdened with. They just, if you've got the money, and this is something the American people need to understand. In Latin America, it is all about the money, as it is in America, of course. But whatever you want, if you've got enough money, you can get it. And so the thing of it was, is essentially, if you we can do it a little analogy here, it's like standing on an elevated platform and screaming free ice cream. Now, who's not going to want free ice cream? Who's not going to want to come to the United States and be taken care of by the United States government, and all they have to do is get there? That was the message.
Let me be the bad guy. Mm-hmm. If you look at, and now I'm moving a little bit forward to the sort of flood that started middle of last year or fall last year.
April of 2014 is when it really hit.
Okay, so the flood that's been coming since then, to me, that flood can't happen unless the American government and intelligence agencies who are deeply operating in all those places, including connected to narcotics trafficking, that's a faucet they can turn on and off. So if the faucet's on, it's because they want it on.
It could happen absolutely without the coordination between the United States government, the governor of Mexico, and the government of the sending nations. Yes.
Right. So
and we had been hearing through the agents that were working it down in the Rio Grande Valley that the United Nations personnel were involved. But as you know, there were threats put out to the contractors that were hired by Health and Human Services and Homeland Security and other entities to work with these people, that if they talked to the press or put out any information about these detainees, that they would be prosecuted criminally. And they told the agents the same thing. So we were getting bits and pieces about the UN, the United Nations personnel being involved. And everybody initially thought, oh, it's the guy with the blue helmets and the blue airplanes and this, that, and the other. And here recently, we actually, there was observed on Fort Huachuca here near Sierra Vista, a light blue C-130 type aircraft that was doing touch-and-go landings at the dirt airfield on Fort Huachuca, and it had the large letters UN on the side of the aircraft. But we come to find out that actually there is an organization within the UN that's called the International Organization for Migration. And that was the group that was involved with bringing these people from the foreign country into the United States through the cooperation with the Department of Homeland Security. And this just came out recently on August the 7th. And then the name of the article is Homeland Security Partnered with the UN, which triggered the border crisis.
So tell us a little bit about the flood that started in April, and then I want to get into some of the reasons, you know, why the U.S. government and et cetera have turned on the faucet.
It's very, very hard to quantify. And let me tell you why. The government is talking about 57,000 unaccompanied minors that were essentially that turned themselves in to immigration officials in the Rio Grande Valley. They're not talking about the underreported number of 240,000 others. A large number of those were women with children. Now, a 25-year-old woman with four children coming to the United States is not going to become gainfully employed. They're going to go onto the welfare system, as are the four children. So they weren't talking about those people. So the first thing we saw, remember, we're talking about intelligence, and we're watching markers and things as they happen and what they mean.
Right.
They were showing you the unaccompanied minor, some of them as young as 3 years of age, which the thought that they got on that train and come up here alone is ridiculous. That didn't happen.
Somebody paid.
Well, International Organization of Migration of the UN may have actually put them on an airplane and flown them here. We don't know. But we do know, in talking to the agents down there, these people were coming into the United States like they just stepped out of the shower. Like they had not been on an international journey or travel or under any duress at all. They were coming with, you know, clean clothes, they had diapers, they had everything else. It's just like they appeared at the border and there was no strenuous journey or travel involved. Well, I can tell you from experience that people that have made that trip, they show the wear and tear when they arrive at the U.S. border.
Right.
Because Mexico is not a friendly environment to pass through.
Right. And a lot of these are coming from countries southern to Mexico. Correct?
In the 80 percentile.
Right.
And here's something else that people aren't talking about and they're not telling you about that has come out. And I sounded the alarm on this back in July. We knew at least 71 of the individuals that had been identified between January 2014 and July 1st of 2014 were from West Africa, which is where the Ebola outbreak was taking place at the time. It's the largest Ebola outbreak in history.
Right.
And it started in four major cities almost at the same time, which is unusual. It usually starts at sort of an epicenter and spreads outward. It doesn't start in four epicenters and make concentric circles. It usually starts in the indigenous population and moves into the larger population and then spreads from there. But this one more or less, it had four epicenters in four major cities in three countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. And I had, you know, I'm always the curious, saw this and know that people from Africa come through Mexico to get into the United States illegally. I mean, that's just the way people come here because it's cheaper to fly to Mexico and take a bus right. And come to the U.S. border and come across. You don't have all the encumbrances of getting a visa from the United States. So we had these 71. That number was updated to over 100. Well, here's the thing. The agents were telling us down there in the Rio Grande Valley that at the height of this surge, that they felt like they maybe were catching 10% of what they saw. So that 71 to 100 now becomes between 700 and 1,000.
Right.
And all you need is one.
Right.
Because the problem with Ebola is the gestation period, and I call it the gestation period, from the time of infection until you show the symptoms can be 2 to 21 days. And you're not contagious until you're showing the symptoms.
Right.
So under current travel restrictions, and I'm talking about restrictions of time of travel, someone could contract the disease in Sierra Leone, in Monrovia, Liberia, let's say, get on a plane, fly to Mexico City, get on another plane, fly to Matamoros, and within 5 days of being infected, still not showing the symptoms, be inside the United States.
Right.
Be apprehended by the Border Patrol, processed 72 hours, whatever it is, taken to a temporary detention facility, where they may start showing symptoms, they may not, in a group of 800 people detained in one location, may or may not infect anyone in that group, and then be released into the United States before they have diagnosable symptoms.
Right.
Now, that's just obvious. And I knew from reading the literature that there is significant information saying that Ebola can be transmitted through aerosol particles. In other words, you don't have to have contact with the person or the infected animal.
Well, if not Ebola, there are plenty of other very dangerous diseases. And I think what you're saying in all your materials is, you know, we have a flood of people crossing the border. And if you look at what we're doing to screen for criminal records or health, all these things, essentially, it's not happening. And clearly the government is encouraging it. And in essence, if you look at all the restrictions being put on the Border Patrol, requiring the Border Patrol to stand down. So the immigration laws are not being enforced. And that's a top-down directive, which is pretty clear. Is that fair to say?
Let me tell you why I'm zeroing in on Ebola.
Okay.
If they will misrepresent the facts about Ebola, how it is transmitted, what else will they misrepresent the facts on?
Well, I think they'll misrepresent the facts on just about everything. Cause
there you go.
I think the situation is much more dire than you do.
But you see, people, when you're talking to people out there on the street, they're distracted. And you have to take and put it in terms that they can relate to before it becomes important to them. And when you show them that something as important as Ebola, and the CDC is telling, and the World Health Organization are telling the airline crews not to use compressed air when they're cleaning the aircraft, make sure you use something with bleach with a certain percentage and all this other stuff. What they're saying is it can be transmitted other than by personal contact. But they're telling you over the TV and in hearings in front of Congress that it can.
Right.
So if they will deceive you about something that is dangerous to the public safety, which is one of the purposes that the immigration laws are written for, is to protect the public safety, what else will they misrepresent the facts about?
Well, there's clearly an effort underway to diminish or destroy the public safety. That's what we're talking
about.
Not only
that, but any negative information about illegal immigration.
Well, let me keep drilling down because I want to get into some of the specifics.
So let's find the gold.
No, it's just, you know, what I find with these kind of big government shifts is that it's a multivariate equation and you got a whole bunch of different constituencies who've decided to get together. So, for example, when I worked for our appropriations would always get slashed whenever the space station came up short money because we were in a bucket with 21 other agencies and, you know, NASA always got the money. So, you know, and what I would find is you go through the appropriations process, you get all these unusual people allying that you would never think are allies. And I think if you look at what's going on here, there's a whole bunch of different drivers that have come together to make for a very big shift. And by sort of unpacking the different specifics and understanding the different risks, it helped people understand what they can do and sort of how to beat the spin. Because the spin for this is very cleverly done. I mean, it's very, all the people, you know, it's
universal.
It's, yeah, so part of it is, I want to help the people who've gotten tricked into believing the spin to understand how to not get tricked by it. So I like to get into the details. So let me just bring up narcotics trafficking because I have a lot of sort of history and experience and research at watching the proceeds of narcotics trafficking really drive U.S. government policy and a lot of the politics. And certainly I never looked hard into Fast and Furious, but Fast and Furious was a perfect example of, you know, you say, who's zooming? Who is the Department of Justice working for here? And it was a perfect example because the U.S. financial system is very dependent on narcotics trafficking, money laundering, including coming out of Mexico. So, but we do know we have the cartels operating. And one of the concerns, of course, is that people coming across the border in this flood include trained, loyal members of the, what is it, M13?
Well, MS-13 is...
I'm sorry, MS-13 and...
...is a gang that originated in El Salvador. But I understand as of today there are more Mexican nationals that are a member of that gang than there are any other. Let me take it from there. For about 4 years, almost 4 years, my frame of reference is July the 1st right now.
Mm-hmm.
Say 3.5 years back from July the 1st, 2014, we were aware or were made aware that the cartel organizations and the MS-13 were in Central America, specifically Guatemala and Honduras, recruiting children as young as 8 years of age into their criminal organizations to be worker bees, if you will, the people that do the street level work. And they were training them more or less, indoctrinating them into the gang. And as they were doing this, they would give them progressively more difficult tasks to do. And as they did this, the individuals they were recruiting would show different levels of aptitude into what they needed. Specifically, they need people that are good at watching safe houses, you know, doing the security, keeping people out, you know, recognizing the need for being invisible in plain sight, if you understand that concept.
Right.
That is.
Now, are they using mind control techniques, or are they just indoctrinating?
Physical intimidation.
Okay.
It is not operated by an employment service like Craigslist or Jobbing.com. You know. It's not at all like that. A lot of times, once a person, say they're 8 or 9 years old, they get far enough into the organization, they know too much about it and they want to get out, they end up being an example.
Right.
And this is where they find people that have a propensity or a desire to kill people. Now, I know this sounds strange to Americans when they start thinking about people 11, 12 years old that are trained assassins, but that's exactly what I'm telling you. That some of these children that they're bringing up here that are children by our definition,
right,
are proven assassins.
Now, you know there's a history of the American intelligence agencies using children as assassins. So it's not completely foreign to the United States. And
no,
you know,
I don't think that we're talking about, in that historical sense, the numbers that we're talking about here.
Right.
And the purpose. And the purpose is, now, this is what I'm hearing from people that are embedded with the cartels in Mexico. Before this surge, they had just under a 50% success ratio of getting these trained illegal aliens, let's just call them illegal, because they come from various places, into the United States. And after the surge and during the surge, they're up in the 90-93 percentile. And so they've almost doubled their ability to get these people in at the same time. They've increased the number of people they're bringing in. Now, what they were doing, and the way that the narcotics distribution works inside the United States, is they have their people inside the United States that are embedded in our society.
Right.
It could be your next-door neighbor. It could be the right guy you sit next to in church. It could be the people that sit on either side of your daughter in her fifth-grade class.
Right.
You don't know who it is.
Right.
But their distribution chain depends on them having reliable personnel that they can maintain an influence over when they're in the United States, an absolute influence, a life and death influence over them while they're in the United States to get their drugs to market. Now, this is a very simple interface. The drugs are produced outside of the United States. They hire a subcontractor to bring it into the United States because it doesn't make sense to try and maintain your own people because it's such high risk you lose a lot of them.
Right.
So they hire people to bring the drugs in and deliver them to your personnel that are already living in the United States.
Right.
And then through the network, they get it to the cities in the United States where the demand for that drug is highest and the price is the highest. Now,
so this flood is really going to give them the ability to build out the networks in the heartland.
Yes. But the reason a lot of these enforcer-type children are being brought in is specifically to be assassins.
Right.
And the reason is, what I'm hearing back from the cartels in the foreign countries, is this. The drugs are sold at the street level in the United States by organized gangs, which is organized crime, by the way. And the organized crime that is being fronted these drugs on a percentage basis is not paying back on what they actually owe the cartels for the drugs that they were fronted.
And then, you mean they're skimming? They're skimming.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
In other words, they're supposed to give back $30,000. They're giving back $27,000.
Gotcha.
They're supposed to give back $3 million. They're giving back $2,800,000. Well, unlike the Americans, they don't allow variances. They frown on that. So they're bringing these people in, a large number of these people in, and they're having their associates, they're already embedded in the United States society, claim to be this person's parents. And this 11 or 12 or 13-year-old kid from El Salvador already has the phone number and name of this person in Chicago. And the person in Chicago already has the name, the photograph of this person, and each of them have their phone number. So the kid calls him for detention in Nogales, Arizona. He comes to Nogales, picks up the kid, gets on a plane with the authorization from the U.S. government to go back to Chicago.
Right.
Now, here's the beauty of this. First of all, it is a certain deal because the United States government is the smuggler, and they insure the transaction between the time he crosses the border, leaving El Salvador, until he arrives in Chicago with the cartel member, the embedded cartel member. So the only thing that that smuggled assassin knows is that one person. And he knows nothing else about the organization. And he lives with that person. This guy is his mentor or this woman. And it can, there's women assassins in Central America. Some of them are
right.
12 years of age.
Right.
And
the beauty of using, the history of using children as assassins is no one can, no one has their guard up. Nobody can fathom that they're an assassin. So they can get in close.
Laws, until they're 18, you can't even treat them like an adult without going through
right.
a rigmarole.
Right.
So essentially the justice system is blind to them by the way our laws are. And so that's why if they bring these people in as children, the United States lawmakers are more likely to make them legal, to sanctify their presence in the United States and more quickly give them a legal status so they can operate throughout the United States with impunity.
Right. One of the things that really got me adamant that I had to get you on the Salieri Report was in one of the videos you mentioned that the Russian mafia is operating with the cartels in Mexico. And
operating out of Mexico City.
Okay.
Now, we didn't see a whole lot of this extreme violence widespread throughout Mexico until we started hearing about Russia and China both establishing diplomatic presences throughout Central and South America. So we're going back prior to the Mérida Initiative in 2006.
Right.
When all these things were happening. We're going back to the last century. We're going back to the late 90s. And, there's a lot of thinking. When you stop and think about, here we go back to intelligence again. Did the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc actually cease to exist? Or did they just take on a new persona? And is it still, instead of being USSR now, it's all KGB?
Well, here's the thing. The best book I've ever read on the Russian mafia was one by a guy named Robert Friedman, who wrote in the 90s. And I was interested because I sort of didn't mean to, but I backed into the fact that a lot of money, the U.S. intelligence agencies and Treasury, was working with the Russian mafia to basically launder tremendous amounts of money out of Russia. And it was coming into Wall Street, and sort of I bumped into it because of some of the financial work I was doing at the time. So I started to read to understand. And one of the things Friedman said, the important thing to understand about the Russian mafia, he said at the time, was it's 99% Jewish. So, you know, it's very different than the sort of Eastern Orthodox Russian church group. And it had made, the Russian mafia had made tremendous inroads into both Israel in terms of control and, you know, into this laundering into New York and Wall Street. And so if you look at the ties they had both in Israel and the power they had in Israel and Wall Street, in the 90s, the idea that they're suddenly showing up and somehow connected to this flood just said, uh-oh. Because, you know, the relationships I saw in the 90s with the U.S. intelligence agencies were very deep. And you're talking about extraordinarily big money, given what happened in Russia. You know, but the people who raped Russia are not loved within Russia right now. So this is a very different. And it's hard for me to imagine the Russian mafia would be acting in alignment and in collaboration with the Russian government.
Unless they're one and the same.
Well, you know, anything can happen, but
politics makes strange bedfellows.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
The idea is the consolidation of power to obtain money, but you have to have money to consolidate the power. And I think that the money laundering, quite frankly, is the most lucrative part of the drug business.
Right.
Because the person that is benefiting from that financially never touches the drugs.
Right.
So
right.
It's very difficult to make a case, especially when you have the institutions of the United States government willfully blind to their activities.
I don't think they're, well, you know, I think the U.S. government encourages and protects the money laundering.
Well,
my experience.
I don't see where they're aggressively pursuing it. The first three banks they hit with money laundering were Bank of America, Wachovia, and Wells Fargo. And after they clarified the cases against them, and they paid, oh, I don't know, it was $20-something million apiece, those three banks promptly merged.
Right.
Then we know that the American mafia, or at least I know other people that know it also, that some of our major stock brokerages are operated by the United States branch of the mafia. So it's the old thing is you go, you don't rob the bank that doesn't have any money in it.
Right.
You rob the bank that has the most money. And banks and financial institutions and people that generate financial instruments, that's where the money is. And the problem here is that the illegal drug business is generating so much money. And, honey, they only deal in cash. They don't take
right.
MasterCard or Visa. It is such large amounts of cash that it cannot be handled without one of our institutions or many of our institutions being corrupted and blinded to the movement of this much physical cash.
Here's what I found. Because I could never, when I worked in Washington, you know, you can make so much more in financial fraud than you can on drugs. I could never understand what was so important about drugs. And then when I live in a small farming community in Tennessee, what I discovered was if you can bring in the drugs, you can end up owning the government in a place, and then you can control all the governmental credits and cash flows. And that's where the big money is. But the drug money, being cash and being very high margin, gives you the ability to get the control of that, particularly, you know, if you can do all these other things we're talking about. And that's where the assassins, if you can command an assassin network, that just makes it that much more important. You can't, you know, the drug money is good, but combine it with a network of assassins, and you're talking about controlling the government budget in every county in America.
In the business world, I think they call that diversification.
Yes.
And being a Wharton graduate, you probably can recognize that faster than others. Yes, that's exactly what's happening.
Well, let me ask you, Zach, about, because I could talk to you for hours, and I got a lot more I want to cover. The question is, why is the U.S. government encouraging this? And I can think of many reasons, but let me mention a couple and see what your take is. Part of the challenge financially in this country is, how do you keep the Social Security system operating? If you can bring in a lot of cheap labor, you don't have to educate and you know, end up putting them on the payrolls, that can help keep Social Security going if you get them in young. Is that a possibility?
You know, it is. But you look... When you look at the level of corruption in our institutions, I think that's too simple. I think they want more money than that. I think that they're more interested in consolidating power. Because, see, if you have got the power, you can get the money.
Right.
So if they can get the votes to render the United States a democracy instead of a republic by being able to control such a large block of the votes. And we're talking about this surge. We're talking about 5 million illegal aliens. We're not talking about 57,000 unaccompanied minors.
Right.
We're talking about 5 million. And we're talking about over 30 million in the country already, of which about 5 million have criminal records in the United States. So it is a tremendous, marketing feat on the part of the government to keep this information from the hands of the people that vote presently.
Right.
So they have to manipulate the information that the American people have about what is actually going on. Or the American people will, you know, if you poke them hard enough and long enough with a sharp stick, they will get mad and they will rise up.
So let me also mention on the other side of this thing, because if you look at, if you look at where I live in Tennessee, we have a cotton gin. And, you know, if it wasn't for the labor coming up from Latin America to do the cotton gin, you know, the gin would have had to close. There just wasn't enough labor and labor willing to do those jobs. And, you know, I just have to say personally, if you look at the 30 million, put the 5 million aside with criminal records, you really, you know, because I'm sure if you look at sort of undesirables, there's plenty in there. But, you know, I've had, I would just say where I live, the Mexican community, you know, they're the ones who bring family values. They're the churchgoers. They do wonderful things with fresh foods. In other words, they have rebuilt a lot of communities here. So there's a portion of this population which has been really good for America.
But where do you stop rewarding illegal activity? And where do you stop it? If they came illegally and they don't have a legal status in the United States, they need to leave.
Right.
Now, so, sorry, but amnesty is rewarding criminal behavior.
Right.
All right. Now, you say that jobs people in America won't do. Are you familiar with the post-Vail, Iowa situation?
No.
This was back during the Bush administration, where they went into this kosher Jewish meat processing plant that was exclusively operated by illegal aliens. Now, if you know anything about a meat processing plant, it's gruesome, dirty, bloody work.
Yes, tough work.
Very few of these people were from Mexico. But when the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people went and arrested these 400 and some odd people, and they didn't get them all because some of them went out the back door, some of them weren't working that day, et cetera. Within 2 days, there was more than enough U.S. citizens applying for a job at that plant to fill the vacancies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that person didn't have extended unemployment benefits and wasn't able to get unemployment simply because there was a job that he didn't want to do, I think it would be a different situation.
Right. Well, you have a lot of people where I live on disability who, if they weren't getting that disability check, would want those jobs.
And there's a whole, there's quite a few people that are actually entitled to disability, but there's also a whole cottage industry grown up against defrauding that system.
Right.
So let's face it. You scream free ice cream and people are going to reach for the free ice cream.
Right.
And there's no
thing as not everybody, Zach. I don't think you would. And I think there are people who won't reach for that free ice cream. It's, I have a great friend who says, government money always comes with a sock in the jaw. And there's some of us who would rather not get it.
Well, you know, look at what it's done to our education system.
Right.
Okay. Is that really a good thing? Look what the Great Society has done.
Well, government money is the way, it's the financial methadone you use to get everybody under central control.
Yes.
So it's a way of quietly implementing central control, and that's the problem. You end up getting dependent on something that ends up making you powerless. So,
right.
That's
which is socialism. Our brand of communism.
Well, socialism, you know, socialism has an enlightened goal, which is not present in this system. I would call it totalitarianism. You're more positive.
This whole idea that the president can just ignore the Constitution and nobody pushes back against him, there's something wrong. There's another dynamic going on.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what it is. When I worked at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, so I once had the secretary say to me, one of the regional administrators told me he was getting yelled at because he had done something, and the secretary said, you know, he said, Mr. Secretary, I had no choice. It was the law. And the secretary said, the law? The law? I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher moral authority. And there was the clear, you know, there was the clear message, the law is a joke. We don't have to obey it. Just, you know, do it, whatever, and it'll take them 10 years in court to get you to reverse it. So there was, you know, clearly an idea of, I don't know if you've ever seen Charlie Ferguson's DVD or documentary on Iraq, but this idea of really destroying civil infrastructure and lawfulness in a way to then completely remake, you know, you destroy a place and wreck it so you can remake it in your own image.
And I think that's what's happening here.
Yeah, I agree.
In America, yeah.
So here's the question. Is part of the goal here just Peggy Noonan had an editorial in the Wall Street Journal the other day where she describes a very rich and powerful guy talking about the fact that America is probably going to be broken up into different countries or different regions. And, of course, if you if you want to get out of the Constitution, you want to get out of obligations to, you know, to the American citizens for a variety of things, you know, playing divide and conquer enough to get the country broken up into different sections as a way to sort of abrogate those contracts and blame it on the people who lose the, you know, who lose their Social Security or whatever. So I guess my next question is, do you think that's part of the goal here, is to just really break up the society?
It is to corrupt our institutions and to so overwhelm the average citizen with all of the nonsense that's going on that they feel powerless and helpless against it. Here's the thing I don't understand. And I've talked to thousands of people in the last few years face to face.
Right.
They understand that the problem is Congress. And their dilemma is that it's up to Congress to fix the problem that Congress created. So they know that the people that they've elected to Congress are the problem, yet they keep voting for the same person and putting them back in. And Congress has held that, what, a single, they're down to 9% to 11% favorability in the United States, but yet people keep voting for the incumbent. So that means, from a practical point of view, that the people that understand how to win elections and have a lot of money are making sure that the people that play the ball game the way they want it played get reelected.
Well, it's funny because I just went out in the primary to vote for my congressperson, who's an incumbent, but she voted against the bailout twice. She's very good on immigration. And I don't know if you know her, Marsha Blackburn. And
I know who she is.
Yeah, so she's I kind of feel like she understands these things and is doing the best on them. She was one of the people who, you know, had the revolution on Obamacare. So she's been pretty good down the line. And I, you know, there's some in there that I find to be very good. And what they're grappling with is, how do they get something done? Okay, let me just touch on some of the more gruesome aspects of what this may be about. We haven't reached those yet, but I just want to check in with you because I think you have the intelligence to know. To what extent are things like slave labor, sex slavery, or organ harvesting part of this, particularly if you're bringing across young minors?
Actually, I became quite concerned about that in Mexico, because they apprehended a man who had some young people that happened to be Mexican citizens. I forget how old they were, but we're talking about young teenagers. He had them sedated and in a cooler in the back of a vehicle. And the story in the newspaper was that these young people were going to be used as donors in an organ harvesting, organs for sale and harvesting transplant scheme in Mexico. Well, you have to understand the basics behind that, and I didn't. So I started looking into it about, you know, we have such a thing in the United States as organ donors.
Right.
People, you know, and so I started looking into what the how this operated, how it had to work. And we're talking about, you don't just take someone that's been killed in an automobile accident or take a heart involuntarily from someone and just randomly give it to somebody that wants a heart.
Right.
You have to have something called a cross match, first of all. So if you have a health system, let's say, in place, perhaps run by the government, and the blood type and DNA cross match and everything is known on these young people, maybe it was collected during their preschool years, and you know where this person is, they know where they go to school, and you can sort of put your hands on them within 48 hours if you wanted to. But you have to have a place to deliver them or the organs live within a matter of hours.
Right.
And you have to have a hospital setting with the full operating room capabilities to affect the harvesting as well as the transplant and implantation of the transplanted organ. So it would require, and these young people were being transported, if I remember correctly, westward towards Sinaloa. It would have to have been a hospital. It would have had to have been through surgeons that were skilled at transplant surgeries. And the young children probably had already been cross-matched, and they had a specific donor awaiting at this hospital. And it would just be too difficult to do that without political protection in Mexico.
Right.
Now, we all know if there's enough money involved that in Latin America, you can buy anything. So if they've got this one person that cross-matches, let's say the person needs a kidney or two kidneys, how much is that worth? $100,000 just for the kidneys? Another $40,000 for the implant and the follow-up care? They're going to be in the hospital for a while.
Right.
Well, if it didn't cost them anything, essentially, for the organs, which the organ donor program in the United States, the only cost is the hospital going to the location of the body and harvesting the organs within several hours of the deceased passing and bringing them back to the donor, I mean the recipient, and putting them in. They've got like 3-4 hours for heart at max. You look at that and say the entire system from intake, in other words, identifying the potential donor, hijacking that person, kidnapping them, taking them off, keeping them alive long enough to put them in contact with the transplant recipient, and then harvesting and essentially killing that young 12 or 13 year old to get their kidneys to put in this person that's got the $100,000 to pay for it.
Right.
It's a pretty gruesome business, but apparently that's what was going on.
Right.
But is Mexico going to admit that? No. They're never in a million years going to admit that that's something that...
Nobody's going to admit that. So let me ask you, you said when I talked to you about the Border Patrol's turning over a certain number of people, but the numbers getting reported are much less.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a discrepancy in the reports on numbers of people?
I think that just came out Friday, where the apprehension tickets and referrals to EOIR, the tickets that the people that are going to process these applications, there's 40,000 less tickets than there were aliens processed by the Border Patrol. And if you're talking about 60,000 people, 40,000 missing is not an insignificant number.
Where did
they go? What did they do with them? Are they in Sevierville, Tennessee? Or are they in Suwanee? Are they in Memphis? I doubt it.
I tell you, one of my concerns is that they're being used as slave labor. So it's, you know, there are two risks. One is they're being let loose all over the place, but the other is, you know, they're concentrated in being used as slave labor in a variety of different ways.
Well, there's a place in Galveston that is a 501c3 or 4, I forget, that prior to this surge received $61 million to get ready to receive these people. So I'm sure they went to some place and had a designated purpose for them before they arrived. And I just don't know what it
is. Right. Well, I think what we're saying is there's a flood. There are a lot of unanswered questions. And
yes, and the United States government is the one doing it.
The frightening thing that I see is you get this spin on the major media that anyone who says, wait a minute, stop, this is dangerous, this is risky, we need to enforce the immigration laws and we need to dig down and look at what's really going on, is marked as a racist, as not humanitarian. In other words, the spin that they're using to defend is quite clever. And,
well,
you know, to be blunt, they're
you're
doing
you're
a lot.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
You know you're over the target when you're taking flak.
Touche.
You know? Look, yeah. If you want to know who the power brokers are afraid of in Washington, look who they attack. Who do the left and the right both attack in Washington? The Tea Party.
Right.
Right? They attack Sarah Palin. They attack Ted Cruz. They attack whoever. If they're not attacking somebody, that's the person you need to worry about. So if someone is up here, like a lot of times when I talk to, I won't name any names. When I talk to congressmen, they just sit there and their jaw just drops open. Well, nobody told us this. I said, you don't.
Do you really believe that?
Outside of the Beltway. All you know is what goes on in Washington. Your focus is on Washington. It's not on the border. It's not talking to the people that live there. You go down there and look at the border. You get your picture taken looking at the fence, and you come back and say you know something about the border. Well, you don't know squat about the border.
Right.
But you don't listen to the people that do, and that's the problem. And that's how my organization got off the ground, was to educate not only the people in Washington, but the people that don't live at the border as to what is actually going on.
Okay, so I'm going to be the bad guy again, Zach.
Do it.
I don't, with very rare exception, every one of those congresspeople has a control file. Not to mention some of them created with the help of children. So they can't do whatever. Yeah, and don't think that some of those children won't be replenished by the flood we're talking about. So they are restricted in what they can do. And let's say they're clean. They don't have a control file. You know, I'm a government official who spent 11 years and $6 million proving that their allegations were false. Not everybody has $6 million in 11 years to prove that phony allegations are false. So, you know, that's why some of the congresspeople who are doing things are pretty courageous. So,
right.
Yeah. So.
And those are the people that ring my phone.
Good. Well, my goal with this Larry Report is to educate people that what you're saying is very serious. They need to listen to this. This is a much more complex phenomena than the corporate media will ever make out. And it's time to pay attention and understand what people along the border know and take it to heart. So let me ask you, what can people do? Obviously, if they have a chance of influencing their, you know, we know Congress with overwhelming interest by the population in most circumstances will do something. Let's say they've done that. Okay, what else can they do in their community?
All politics is local.
Right.
Now, understand that I try to be apolitical, but in America, that's impossible. because it's true. So
right.
I'm not really, and I say that both political parties are the root of the problem because they're not focused. Here, this is what the American people are telling me. The people in Washington are reaching beyond the American people. They're ignoring their needs and the needs of their children and reaching out to other people that don't vote for them, that aren't American citizens, and are putting their rights and privileges, which they really aren't entitled to, ahead of the United States citizen and their children. Let me give you a very clear example of that. You're aware that Javier Vega, a Border Patrol agent, was killed in South Texas recently.
Yes.
You're aware of the Javier Vega murder?
Yes.
Where he was out fishing?
Yep.
Well, he was the second Border Patrol agent that had been robbed while they were out fishing. So he and his parents, now, we're talking about a grandmother and a grandfather, a son, a wife, and three grandchildren, go fishing. And to go fishing where they've gone fishing since the son was a little boy, they wear handguns and take an AR-15 rifle. So while they're fishing, these two illegal aliens try to rob them. Javier gets shot and killed. And the only reason that the people that killed Javier leave the scene is because the grandma has an AR-15 and she's shooting at him. We're coming to the point in America where it's going to be the grandmothers are going to have to pick up the AR-15s and defend their grandchildren, because that is who is under attack, is the next generation.
It's all right, well, come to Hickory Valley, where all us older women are trained in arms.
Should
yeah.
I? In Los Angeles?
I agree.
But this is what I'm saying is the rest of America lives in la-la land. They don't understand, and it wasn't reported in the media, that it's grandma that saved the grandchildren with what Mayor Bloomberg would call an assault rifle.
Right.
Had she...
Right, well, that's my...
Possibly all of them would be dead right now.
Right, that's my next question. Do I need to step up from semi-automatic? But so what can somebody do other than obviously being trained and carry weaponry and network in their community to make sure that safety is, you know, I make a big deal about making sure to get the right local sheriff, and we have a great local sheriff here, and a lot of people went to a lot of trouble to make sure that happened. What else can people...
He's your most
yeah.
important elected official.
Yeah.
Next is do you have a local elected group that practices sanctuary city policies? Are they an immigrant-friendly community? That's the same thing as being a sanctuary city.
Mm-hmm.
If they are, you need to get somebody else in that office. Because sanctuary city means that you overlook the illegal alien in your presence from a law enforcement perspective. And let me tell you, I've dealt with these people for years and years and years and years. I have relatives that are from Mexico. I am very aware of how they think and operate. They are not given or disposed, even if they see something criminal, a murder, take place right before their eyes. They are not disposed to be witnesses.
Right.
They will more than likely say, even if they get blood splattered off the gunshots on their shirt, oh, I didn't see or hear anything. I don't know what you're talking about. We don't need those kind of people in the United States. I'm sorry.
Right.
Okay. What the people in the United States don't understand is that these folks aren't like us.
Well, I just have to say, I do have to say one thing. I was, I won't bore you with the details, but one of the reasons I'm alive today is a gentleman from El Salvador fleeing the political persecution in that country who had immigrated legally to the United States, gave an affidavit, volunteered, told me about a situation, gave an affidavit, and literally saved my life from a lot of criminal prosecution by federal scallywags. It's another story, but I think the challenge with all these things is how do we sort out, you know, the respectable citizens from the slugs, and that's the challenge, and it's very hard to do, and we're having a problem doing it in our own communities, let alone doing it with foreigners coming across the border.
As you probably don't know and may suspect, my organization put together a program to address that.
Good.
It's called the CIER, Comprehensive Immigration Enforcement Reform.
Uh-huh.
And delivered it to every single member of Congress in the U.S. Senate.
Uh-huh.
And we have gotten, we call it being consciously unaware. let's just put it this way. They know exactly, we are the immigration experts. National Association of Former Border Patrol Officers combined have thousands of hours and years of immigration experience. I just have 26. We got people in my organization that got 38.
Uh-huh.
We got people that ran the amnesty programs in different regions. We've got people that have been operating with the IRA, the 96 Act, right on up through the current programs. We know that just by the stroke of a pen, this president can just send all these people back.
Right.
He's the one that invited them up here, so he's not likely to do that.
So here's my suggestion. I would like everyone to come to your website and take a look and consider joining or supporting the organization. And the URL can you give the URL?
It's National Association of Former Border Patrol Officers, the first letter of each word, .org. NASBPO.org.
And you'll okay, find, so I sent in.
You'll find the CIER report on the front page. And we redid the websites. It's supposed to be on the upper left. I haven't looked at it since yesterday.
So I sent in an application to support. I want to become a member, so I'm hoping everybody will.
Supporting member, yeah.
I will either become a supporting member or donate or help in whatever way they can, because I think the knowledge you guys have is just invaluable. That's number one. Number two, if you're ever in Washington again and you're heading over to Congress, I want you to let me know so I can try and get you an appointment with Marsha Blackburn, because I would love to make sure that she and her staff have access to all your resources.
Well, you know, it's funny. Almost all of the people that we presently talk to in Washington, the elected officials, have reached out to us.
That doesn't surprise me.
We did not reach out to them.
That doesn't surprise me. Well,
this is odd, and this is what we found out. There are so many people trying to walk in the front door and get the congressman's attention or this, that, and the other. They're just automatically resistant to it. It's like they've been vaccinated against people that walk in and want to talk to them. But if a major...
So I will email them and ask them to contact you.
That's what works.
Okay. Then that's what I'll do.
I'm not talking about 98%. I'm talking about 100% of the successful associations we had came because a constituent of that member of Congress recommended that they did this and sort of held their feet to the fire.
Right.
Now, I've even had the constituent give me the congressman's personal telephone number and email. I won't use it. We're an advisory group. You have to call us, and we only go where we're invited. If we're not invited,
okay.
I'm not going to try and push myself on. We did go around and distribute our CIER reports to the offices.
Right. Okay. Right.
But that's as far as we went. We made it available to them. And it's funny that some of the congressmen that end up reaching out to me that I know, personally know, that they were delivered a copy of that CIER have never heard of it before. So in other words, their staff didn't give it to them.
Well, let me see what I can do, but I would encourage anybody else listening who would like to also do the same with their congressperson, because I think the more Congress knows how to implement immigration reform and how to make sure the laws are really adhered to, the better. And I think you guys can help. So before we close, is there anything else? I've certainly grilled you and pushed you to go fast, so I apologize for my rudeness. I just wanted to make sure. I still got a list of 20 more. I got 20 more questions.
I've got 3 more hours, so just have your way with me right now. Let's do some basic immigration 101.
Okay.
What do you say?
Perfect.
Immigration laws, as they were enacted in the 52 Act, which is what we're operating under today, is the framework of the immigration, the INA, Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1952, is designed to do two things. Protect national security and public safety. National security is totally dependent upon the American economy and American jobs for American people. Public safety, which includes public health, is the ability of the United States citizen and the lawfully admitted alien to remain secure in their persons and properties, both from within and without especially from invasion. And when mm-hmm. we say public health, we're talking exactly about what's happening and has been happening for the last 4 months in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas.
Right.
If the American, see, what it appears to me is happening is they're trying to dilute and render meaningless what it means to be an American and what it takes to become an American. Because they're starting in the preschool years of indoctrinating kids in the public schools.
Right.
So when these kids grow up, they don't think there's anything wrong with violating the Constitution or having a dictator as a president or thinking that all these other subjective reasons why we're doing things are okay and never understanding the objective purposes of what the immigration law is. So as a person grows up in the American society as it exists, that's what molds the American. That's what makes us unique. And it's not the capitalist system. It's even more than the free enterprise system. It is being raised in freedom.
Right. So I would say
in America and the founding fathers was on faith.
Right. So
family and freedom. Those three things. And what they're trying to do is to dilute the influence of those. Christianity is under attack in the United States right now. A preacher cannot get up and talk about the evils of some social diseases without being charged with hate speech.
So here's what I would say is we have in America, we have a covenant, and that covenant comes under the Constitution and a couple of the founding documents. And to me, one of the most provisions in those documents is that our freedom comes to us, you know, by divine right, not from government, and government works for the people. And if you look at that covenant, it's a sense of we, who we are, you know. And it's funny because, you know, my cousin lives in Times Square, and they have this Pentecostal church next door, and you'll go in and everybody's talking about we, and it looks, you know, they're like two of everything. It's Noah's Ark, but they're talking about we, and that's because they believe that we should be free and we should, you know, be founded in the love of the, I'll say, you know, I'll be multicultural and say divine, but, you know, and there's a covenant. And part of what happens when you flood in too many newcomers without any process of transition to join the covenant, you bust the covenant. So I would say it that way, but I agree with you.
In this case, outvote them.
Right.
And that's what they're trying to do is develop a group of voters that did not grow up under that ethos. Look, when they attacked the Boy Scouts of America and went after them, that should have been a clue to everybody in the United States that this was a divisive government. Because, my God, what else do they give us to make men out of but boys?
Well, here's the thing, Zach. There's so many things. I mean, part of my bugaboo is drugs. When you bring hard narcotics into 3,100 counties, one county at a time, I think you've pretty much made it clear that you don't value American citizens.
Well, and the way they've done it is political deception.
Right. That's very clever.
They could not do it without the press. Let me give you an example, please. Mayor Bloomberg. Standing in front of the microphone down in Manhattan, New York City. He's talking about the evils of trans fats in French fries. And the sugar in 32-ounce sodas. And right behind him in public school, they're selling heroin at $1 a milligram, a historical low. 12-year-old children are mixing this with cough medicine and producing a heroin derivative that can be taken orally called cheese.
Right.
And they're dying of overdose in the bathroom during recess in the public schools in New York. And he's standing up there talking about trans fat and french fries and sugar and sodas. That's political deception.
Right.
And Mayor Bloomberg is
really good at it.
he's taking it to an art form.
But Bloomberg's quite good at it.
He couldn't do it without the media. Give you another example. I was in Dallas, June of 2013. Front page of the Fort Worth paper, it said, Director, Department of Public Safety, State of Texas, has labeled Dallas-Fort Worth as a cartel hub city. And it went on to tell all about the 22 murders and how the cartel influence is so comfortable in the cities of Dallas and Fort Worth that they've made it a hub city because they can more or less transact their business without being bothered by the local police, yada, 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 yada. And I'm sitting there reading this newspaper, and I'm in a hotel room, and I look at the news later that day, and it's the city council of this Fort Worth, and there's two minority members. And they're having a spirited argument with two other members of how bad it is for the city of Fort Worth to allow its people to use plastic bags within the city because they look so trashy blowing across vacant lots throughout the county. They're not talking about the drug cartels taking over their city.
Right, but they're talking about what's safe to talk about. So
conservation,
you know,
the environment, all of that are tools that these people are using to deflect our attention away from what is important.
I saw this when I worked at HUD. You were operating up against a force that had an infinite amount of financial resources and had the power to kill with impunity. And so everyone was scared. And when you got whacked, everybody gets scared and they'd start simply making, you know, the things that they could talk about more complicated so they could spend more time on that. And it was an avoidance scheme, and they weren't always conscious of it. They were just scared. And I, no, I'm talking about fear because, you know, we're up against a force that has enormous powers of surveillance and enormous powers of intelligence, and they are very violent. So, you know, I know more than a few politicians are scared to death. Now,
yeah, that's obvious.
Right. So the question is, how can we be savvy and effective? Because, you know, if you look at the times when we've won, we won on homeschooling, we won on the right to bear arms, we won on not getting the swine flu vaccine mandated. If you look at the times when we've won, you know, it's because you've got enough people saying no. And that's the question. How do we get enough people understanding this issue and getting to the point where they can say no, and they make each other. I don't know if you've ever seen that video up on the internet. I'll send it to you about the water buffalo who get up enough group nerve to, you know, to beat the lions. And that's the question. How do we gather together and get up enough group nerve to take on the predators? Because that's what you're dealing with.
The secret lies within the hearts of the American people.
Yeah, that's true.
Emotion is the language of politics. And what has happened is they have been so rendered numb, N-U-M-B, by all of the background noise that they're unable to decipher what is important and what's not. Let me tell you, if the American people did not rise up when they took the Pledge of Allegiance and prayer out of public schools, that was the time to have risen up and fought.
I think a lot of them didn't understand at the time.
I don't think they. I think they didn't want to understand.
No, because I didn't understand when that happened. I didn't understand that part of it. Was I was
yeah, I did.
Distracted. you were smarter than me.
No.
But I really didn't understand.
You see, there's what my dad used to tell my grandfather. He says there's a big difference between intelligent and being smart.
Well, I wasn't that smart, but I'm getting smart. I'm catching up. I'm getting smarter.
Yeah, but
anyways,
you have to learn by experience, right?
Right.
The only way you get smart is through experience.
Right.
Yeah, intelligence, you know, you can get that in school. You can read it in the newspaper. But the only way you find out whether or not it does or doesn't work is to put it in the process and to actually do it.
Okay, well, for me to... for
education and then figured out how to make things work in the workplace, now those people are smart.
Yeah, they are smart. So I got to get the subscribers to listen to this, and if I make it any longer, they won't.
So, that's the problem. They're not interested.
Oh, they are interested. Zach, can I tell you, they are interested. My subscribers are wonderful. These are smart people. They listen. They invest a lot of time in learning. They are smart. But they're going to get it after, you know, they got it by now. They know what they need to do. So I need them to go out and, because remember, I'm going to try and get them to listen to the videos too. Okay?
You're my Shiro.
Okay, so I'm going to email Marsha Blackburn's staff, and if there's anything I or the Solari team can do to support you and your organization, you have only to let us know, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye.
I hope this was illuminating to everyone.
Oh, I think this was very illuminating, Zach, and I can't thank you enough. You have a great day.
It's not going to be easy.
If you have faith, it should be.
Well, see, that's the whole point. If it was going to be easy, they would send somebody else.
You're the potter. I am the clay.
Catherine, this is what it comes down to. Have you ever read the Bible much?
Oh, I read it. It's what General Patton said. I read it every goddamn day.
Remember when David took charge of the army of the Israelites and he was trying to pick a group of men to go against the Philistines?
Uh-huh.
And he led them down to a stream. He had his two captains lead him down to a stream. And they observed the men as they were drinking water. And
this is Gideon.
They held their staffs up at the ready and kept watching the rim of the stream and dipped their hand down and drank while they were looking.
No, my friend, that is Judges chapter 6 to 9. That is Gideon.
It's whoever. But,
it's Gideon.
But anyway,
nope, it's Gideon.
I think it was less than a third of the total men he had to pick from.
Right.
He picked the warriors.
Well, but remember, Gideon called them two times. The first time the angel of the Lord said to him, those people are not effective. Not everybody is with you is effective. And Gideon's like, wait a minute, I don't even have enough people to go up in the Midianites. Now you're telling me I have to send some home? So basically they sent the scared guys home. I had a partner who used to say, before you rob a bank, you got to get everybody together and send the scared guys home. And then the angel of the Lord comes back and says, no, you know, you got the faithful with you. They believe, but now they're not all competent. So then they did the test down at the water. And that's what left Gideon with 300 men who were both faithful and competent. And that was what the Lord was saying. I need faithful and competent to work through. I'm not going to do this. You're not going to do this, Gideon. I'm going to do it. But I need some faithful and competent people to work through. That's my favorite story in the Bible, Zach.
In every army, every member of the army is a soldier, but not everyone's a warrior.
Right. Right.
We got to activate the warriors.
Yeah, we got to find 300 at least.
At least.
At least.
In this case, 435. Because
okay, well, let me work on my one. Okay. You have a nice day, no matter how hard it is. Okay? Bye.